Welcome to Thriving with Arthritis. I'm Dr. Diana Garnita, your host and an experienced rheumatologist. In this podcast, we explore arthritis and autoimmune diseases, covering topics like rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, gout, and much more. From valuable insights to cutting-edge research, this podcast is your guide. Whether you are new to this condition or you are a long-time warrior, Thriving with Arthritis is here to support you. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Thriving with Arthritis. Today, I'm incredibly honored to have with me Dr. John Kush. He is a leader, a researcher, and an author to many, many publications, but also books that made a huge impact in the field of rheumatology. Dr. Kush, not only that he is a clinical professor of medicine, but he did serve in a lot of leadership positions for the National Arthritis Foundation, but also for the American College of Rheumatology. He did extensive research, not only in rheumatoid arthritis, but also in the field of biologic. And who is better than Dr. Kush that we have today here to answer questions for us about arthritis and especially about rheumatoid arthritis? Dr. Kush, I am humbled that you have accepted my invitation and you take from your precious time to dedicate to education. And I should say one more thing. Dr. Kush is a pioneer in digital education because that's important. He founded RoomNow.com, who is today a leading resource for the latest developments that are happening in rheumatology. Myself, I follow your platform and I learn every day from what you publish. So I want to congratulate you for taking that position and the leadership in educating us, Dr. Kush.
Thank you, Diana. It's a real honor to be on the podcast with you. I've been following you since I think we first met a year or two ago when you were lecturing at the same symposium I was, and I was so impressed. And this is a great opportunity for us to talk about what we're both interested in, hopefully what the audience is interested in, and that being arthritis and rheumatoid arthritis.
Perfect. I talk about rheumatoid arthritis very often. This is a big, big interest that I had going into the field of rheumatology. And I know that our audience has a great interest about rheumatoid arthritis, but especially what are some ways that we can prevent rheumatoid arthritis?
It is a very important and difficult question that clinicians and researchers struggle with. I think it's best to assume that you don't have rheumatoid arthritis and you're likely to be right, meaning that people will worry about having rheumatoid or having arthritis and then wasn't that rheumatoid? And, you know, the name gets tossed around a lot, a little too easily. And ultimately, if you really believe you have rheumatoid arthritis or arthritis, you should see someone, a rheumatologist preferably, who can diagnose this very easily and with a great deal of certainty. The key thing about rheumatoid arthritis and whether you may or may not have it is its chronicity, meaning that it's been going on a while now. It has to go on for more than 12 weeks. It doesn't relent. It tends to get worse over time, but it is a different kind of arthritis. It's 110 different kinds of arthritis. But asking the question, how do you prevent rheumatoid arthritis? I think it's best to focus on who's really at risk. And who is really at risk? We know from many, many studies that it's first degree relatives of someone who has diagnosed rheumatoid arthritis. And how do you know that? Well, they've been diagnosed and they're also taking medicines and they're usually being cared for by a rheumatologist. So if a first degree relative of yours has rheumatoid arthritis, and then you yourself are having joint pains with or without swelling, now you're somewhat more at risk than the average person on the street. And, you know, the risk is for anyone out there is less than 1%. But if you are a first degree relative and you have arthralgias, the next thing to do is go to a doctor and get a rheumatoid test. If your rheumatoid test positive, you got those three things, family history, you know, a positive test and joint pain. Well, that's who we worry about because that person has about a 30% chance of progressing to rheumatoid arthritis. We do know that at this stage, early stage, where there's a lot of more questions than diagnoses, that you can do certain things that will maybe improve your odds and lower your risk. Number one on that list by far and away is, for God's sake, stop smoking. Smoking is a bad, bad player. It is the gasoline on the fire of what might be rheumatoid arthritis. So stop smoking at all costs. Second thing is clean up your diet. We all talk about we're going to clean up our diet and think we should know, and we know what we're supposed to do. We don't, because my goodness, I do love a good enchilada and the basket full of chips that comes with it. But we know that that's bad for us. So going, losing weight, obesity and smoking are big contributors. But then, you know, maybe going on an anti-inflammatory diet, which generally is something that's either Mediterranean diet or one that is low in carbohydrates and one that has no gluten in it. These things can help. The last thing are two more things. One is dentistry. Your oral cavity can be a big contributor to what's going on. So if you got a lot of dental problems and cavities and gingivitis, my goodness, please fix that, because your immune system is looking for triggers to take RA or just joint pain to the next level, and that's swollen joints and damage. And it gets those triggers from your mouth and from your lungs, which is why pollution can be a big problem. If you live in a high pollution area, maybe you might consider not living in a high pollution area. I'm talking about pollution, right? Like smog and things like that. So again, diet, weight loss, obesity, dental care, gingival care, and environmental pollutants. And by the way, smoking is like the worst environmental pollutant. Doing all that makes sense. What doesn't really work is everything else. I've omitted talking about a lot of other things, but you'll hear a lot of trash talk from people who mean well, who don't have the expertise as we rheumatologists do.
I have to agree. I educate heavily patients about the role of lifestyle into, you know, preventing rheumatoid arthritis. There are actually studies out there that patients that do not smoke, or, you know, patients that lose weight, patients that actually have approached a healthier diet, and patients that stress less, that do have a decreased risk of rheumatoid arthritis. When a patient is thinking that he has rheumatoid arthritis, how should they look for a rheumatologist? How do they find, how would you recommend them to find a great doctor that they can diagnose and treat them?
It can go many, many ways. I've often told my patients, I think that the worst recommendation comes from doctor to doctor. I wish I could say that I can tell you who to see, who's a really good doctor in Cleveland or in Tacoma or on Long Island, but I don't know all those doctors. I tend to refer you to people who I think are nice people, you know, great gal, really smart, very funny, you know, smart guy, does the research. That is no assurance that that person is going to be a good doctor for you. A good doctor for you is by far and away the person who A, listens, and B, gives a damn. And you're not going to know that until you get in the room, and you're going to know that from the first 15 minutes of talking to that person. Do they listen to me? Are they concerned about me? Or are they just going to lecture me? Are they going to tell me 29 things to do because they think I want to hear everything that they say? And I know when you're looking for a doctor, you don't really want to hear everything I know about your question. You want to know that I'm going to be with you as you deal with this question. So my advice is to ask a lot of people that you know. And I do this when I'm trying to hire someone. I ask a lot of people that I know. And then when I hear the same name come up more than once, well, that's someone I'm going to write down. And then you can certainly do online reviews. And I'll tell you frankly that I think I'm great. My mother says I'm great, but my reviews aren't always great because I'm kind of guilty of telling the truth. Sometimes the truth hurts. And I think people would prefer if I were a little softer and a little more genial about things. And I've had to learn from my patients about how to be a better doctor. So I think a 5-star, 4-star rating on the online reviews is very encouraging. That tells you a lot about the person's persona and attitude, but that's not where the only thing. So I think hearing it from multiple people, and I like to ask not just people who have arthritis or rheumatoid arthritis, I like to ask nurses. You know, nurses, especially in hospital systems, they know who they're going to send their mother to. And I do know who I'm going to send my mother to. And I'm going to go for the best doctor possible. But I guess I want to get away from thinking that your primary care or the doctor who lives next door to you might be the best person to ask when you're looking for a rheumatologist.
I love the fact that you mentioned about listening and resonating, you know, with patients. And I love the fact that you mentioned about the reviews, that although it seems unfair sometimes, and we don't own those reviews, but sometimes the patient will judge us for those reviews. there are some problems that I see with reviews. We as doctors, especially if you work in a traditional system, we never encourage our patients to write about us. And even if they go to write about us, if we leave that system, then those reviews will disappear with our leaving the system. But, you know, what I discovered doing my own journey in my own private practice is that most of the time, patients that are happy with our care, they will never go to write the review because they don't think about that. Most of the time, what's happening is that patients that are unhappy, they will go there and will say why they are unhappy with a practice. So I think that goes both ways. It serves the patient, but it's also going to serve us if we encourage our patients to leave us reviews, especially in the world that we live, that people believe more in the internet than they believe in a doctor. Now,
I shouldn't apologize for doctors because, you know, no one really feels sorry for us. But, you know, I don't think patients understand the doctor's approach, you know, before they got there. And the doctor's approach was, I'm going to study, you know, for the last 10 years or 20 years to be the absolute smartest, best person when it comes to answering your question. And I want to give you everything I have. And along the way, I may not have developed great social skills, but I have great knowledge and great insight and great options. But if I don't communicate that well or with patience and with diplomacy and kindness, then I lose points as whether I'm a good doctor or not. And so I think a lot of doctors who are kind of automatic or robotic or don't have great, they don't want to listen so much, they want to talk a lot, you know, many of them are going to be very good, but will they meet a good? Bottom line is I'm the employee and the patient is the employer. You're hiring me to do a job. You don't like the way I'm doing my job, fire me and find another employee that suits your needs, because it is really all about you.
Can patients teach us to become better doctors?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Listen, bit by bit. I'm in my 60s and still learning.
Same here. And what did you learn from your patients, Dr. Kush?
Listening is probably the most important thing. You know, listening from their perspective is really important. And the other things I've learned is something I have pasted on the computer where I'm writing down all their notes. And my patients want hope and understanding. So what I have written down on every computer is hope, goals, and rules. These are what I have to give every patient at every visit. I need to give them goals to set up the expectation that we can do better. I need to give them rules on how they're going to get there. And my patients have indirectly taught me that I need to set expectations during my visit with them about what they can expect, what's going to happen between now and next visit, what's going to happen with this medicine I'm starting, what's going to happen in the future. You know, will they be off of all medicine, or will be all, or are we forever linked with a chronic illness? So setting expectations, I mean, a good example is telemedicine and doing visits by Zoom and video and phone calls. I had to set expectations with my patients that this is not a social call. I'm not calling to say, hey, how are you? And what's going on with the kids in your golf game? You know, this is, we're going to do some medical questioning here and some examination things and review of your medicines and refills. And, you know, we're going to meet your needs just like we were if we were face to face. But, you know, sometimes like it's new things, you got to set expectations. So the patient, my job is to teach a patient how to be a better patient. And guess what? They don't want to be patients at all. And I don't blame them. But we got to deal with the realities of their predicament, whether it's like the patient I saw today at noon who just had a new onset of knee pain. And he had a very brief problem that we're going to fix real quick. And he's not going to have a long-term problem. But the patient after him, we're dealing with a chronic illness. And I got to set expectations on where that's going. So again, I have to meet the needs of the patient. I do have to give hope, goals, and rules. And I need to stop talking. I have a problem of talking too much. And that's one of the reasons Diana, you and I get along, because you let me talk and I let you talk. And we love when we each talk to each other. But sometimes we need to spend more time listening, because, well, the famous quote from Sir William Osler is, listen to the patient. He's telling or she's telling you the problem.
That's very true. I had to start listening to my patients. I was trying to deliver too much in a visit. And I realized that the patient just needs some time, needs some space to tell me what are his expectations, his fears. And I learned in time that I have to listen to and to bend based on their fears, their expectations, because it doesn't matter that I believe that a drug is going to make miracles for them if they don't believe that. I have to let them or lead them in that direction. And as you said, you know, patients have to communicate with us. They have to see us as not only as doctors, but also part of their team, the healers for them. What I also want to say is that patients, like you said, patients gives us a lot of the information. We just have to be receptive on whatever or wherever they want to go on their journey. And we have to understand them because they are the one in pain. They are the one that every day they have to take a medication. So it's difficult for the patient to engage into a treatment if he doesn't believe or if she doesn't believe that that's going to bring relief. So thank you for bringing those.
Let me comment on what you just said about it's difficult to get the patient to believe when it's not meeting their expectations or when you're just proposing something new. And I think it's important for patients to realize sometimes if you come in to see me because you've got, you know, a sore throat and a cough and you're not feeling good and you're expecting an antibiotic or some specific treatment or, you know, that you have an expectation going in and then the doctor doesn't meet your expectations. In fact, gives you something totally different, totally unexpected. And I recognize that difficulty for the patient and I have to stop them and say, let's just stop a second and recognize that often what you're asking me to do has been done by every other doctor before you saw me in some other variation, and that you've been doing this sort of thing, things that meet your expectations, things that are within the realm of possibility in your research and what you've learned. But then again, you're not better. And here I am giving you something totally different. You know, I'm suggesting to you to go to the dentist and get your cavities fixed when you're complaining of joint pain. And he's like, is he an arthritis doctor or a dentist friend? You know, but I think you have to recognize that when I do something that is so different, it is because I see that this is the right opportunity that you have not yet been offered. And it's up to me to one, give it to you and then explain to you why it is worth your effort. That's hard sometimes to accept.
That's very true. Now, many times patients, when they come to us, they don't know what to tell us first. What would you advise a patient to do before they come to see us?
I think the first thing would be to assess the office and their ability. You know, I'm a patient. I'm going to go see Dr. Diana. I want to assess Dr. Diana's office before I get there, meaning how available were they to me? How responsive were they to me? How easy was it to do this? How nice or unnice were they? You know, I think sometimes what goes on in the office reflects what goes on in the doctor's brain and operation as well. So you can evaluate the clinic to some extent by how that happens before you get there. And I know I made two of my own medical appointments today, and I got to tell you, they were very frustrating and circuitous and run around and didn't make a whole lot of sense, weren't very logical. But I've also been to those doctors before, and I know that the office is a good office, and I know the doctor's a good doctor. But you can evaluate things before you get there. Second thing is I think you need to know why you're going. If you don't know why you're going, then, you know, if I'm starting out the visit, why are you here today? And the patient says, I don't know. My reflex is to say, all right, well, we're done. You know, I mean, I don't know I don't know how hard I have to fish to find a problem and whether I should be fishing for a problem in you. So if you're not clear on why you're going to see the specialist or a new doctor, find out why and find out why that doctor, that's really going to be helpful. The things that you can do along the way is to really help you is to have two things in hand. One is a list of your medicines or a bag full of all your medicine bottles, because you may not remember them. You certainly may not be able to pronounce them or spell them. Drug names are very difficult even for doctors, and you certainly may not know the doses. It's very important that the doctor know what you're taking so that he or she can safely give you something else that won't interact or won't duplicate, which could be a good problem and a bad problem. And the other thing that you need is, what are your top three complaints? What are your top three things? And I like symptoms and complaints rather than questions. Questions can be, you know, what are you going to do about the national debt? You know, I mean, that's a 2-hour discussion. I don't really want to get into that, you know, but I do want to get into why I can't afford the medicines that you're prescribing me. So to have a list of the 3 top things you want the doctor to fix in you, you know, when you go to primary care, sometimes you only get one thing. Seeing a specialist, I think you should be able to get your 3 top things. Usually those 3 things are kind of intertwined in the same problem and the same solution to that problem. So that's what you need to do in preparation for your visit. And by the way, that applies to all visits, meaning follow-up visits as well.
I totally agree. You have to come up with a plan when you see a doctor, and you have to know why you're there. I have to agree with that. Now, you know that we are not many rheumatologists in the country. As far as I know, we are about 3,000 rheumatologists, and there are about 60 million people with autoimmune diseases and about 60 million with arthritis itself. So it's not enough of us. And not only that, but after the pandemic, there were a lot of rheumatologists that retired. So now what I do find out is that there is a huge need for patients to see a specialist like us, but they don't know what to do when the doctor retire. When their rheumatologist retire, they don't know where to go. And it's harder and harder for them to find a new one. Do you have any tips for our patients?
Yeah, I was texting 2 of my patients today, old patients. I retired from my university practice in July of 21, and I still stay in touch with a bunch of patients. They have my phone. They text me with questions and whatnot. And anyway, a few of them are losing the doctor that I assigned to them. So in the span of 2 years, they've lost 2 doctors that they trust. And that's very nerve-wracking, very scary for someone who has a chronic serious illness that's been controlled or managed to their satisfaction. My advice is, 1, it's probably better to stick with someone who's in that same practice, mainly because your information is already there, mainly because it's likely that your case, your situation, your management has been discussed with other doctors in the practice. We do that all the time. We sit next to each other when we're working, and I ask the nurse practitioner on my right and the rheumatologist on my left, all right, guys, what would you do? You know, here's a 37-year-old woman. She wants to get pregnant, and what would you do? And, you know, what would your advice be? And I think that that can help ease your transition. But at the same time, you're now going to have a relationship with a different style of doctor, a different kind of person. The last one was short, the new one's tall. The last one's a good listener, this one's a talker. You know, the last one was funny, this one has never cracked a smile. That doesn't mean that they're bad. That means that they're different. And just like, you know, as we get older, you know, you don't always get your best choice, first choice. This is not Burger King. You got to get the best choice that's on the table. So the immediate goal is a transition era. Like, so when your doctor's leaving and then you need care in the next 3 to 6 months, the best transition is going to be in the same center, the same clinic with another doctor there. Second thing is, don't be afraid. And if you ask me, I think you should run to see the nurse practitioner or the physician assistant who worked with your doctor. If your doctor was great, I guarantee you their nurse practitioner and physician assistant is going to be great too. And they can do everything just as well, almost always. And that's always worked out for my patients. And then after that, I must say it's a little bit like having to date all over again. And I wish there was something like speed dating so that you could pick your doctor, you know, more easily. We don't market ourselves very well. You know, we don't put ourselves out there. And I think it goes back to the very first question that you asked me, how do you find a good doctor? You ask around, you ask a lot of people, you ask other healthcare workers and nurses, you know, and when you start hearing the same name coming up, go to someone. And you know what? You may have to interview and fire 3 in a row before you find the one that's really good for you. And recognize that there are good doctors come in many shapes and sizes and looks and whatnot. I always like my story about my roommate in medical school. And, you know, my medical school was 1977. It was a very white, male dominated class, and all the roommates and all the other classes of rooms around. And they, you know, they had people that looked like me and talked like me. And then my roommate shows up. I'm 22 and he's a 35-year-old man from Pakistan with a turban on, and he had business clothes, but he wore traditional clothes when he was relaxing. And I thought, my goodness, this is going to be such a disaster. I have no idea what this man is like culturally or whatever. And the good news is I had to room with him. And in 6 months, or not even 6 months, 3 months, I learned, oh my goodness, what a wonderful person. He was the best roommate I've ever had of roommates I ever had. He was kind. He was wonderful. He's smart. He was wise. So the idea is, you know, if I judge someone based on the book based on the cover, I would never have chosen that man. And I'll tell you today that Dr. Rahman was just outstanding. And it was the best choice I never made. It was just thrown upon me, and how lucky was I? So luck could also play a role.
That's incredible. And I love the fact that you shared that story, because we, as much as we don't want to recognize, we do judge based on the first impression. Many times when we enter the room, we tend to judge people based on whatever exposure we had in our past. How comfortable are we with that culture or with that person appearance? And is not always right. I love that. You know that many patients, and I see that in my practice is primarily based on telemedicine, do see patients in person, Irvine, California, but I do see patients in many states. And I have to tell you that there are so many patients away from the big cities, away from the metropolitan cities. Even those, they have trouble to find the rheumatologist. But for the other ones, the ones that are living in more rural states or rural America, it is a struggle to even access a rheumatologist. They either have to travel for, you know, hundreds of miles, or they will never get to a rheumatologist. So whoever assumes their care, they do whatever they can for these patients. So what should these patients do? What are their chances to get a good rheumatology care?
So Dr. Trinita and I are big believers in the power and value of telemedicine, where I can and she can see you remotely. You can be at home in front of your computer and I can be in my office, and we can get a lot accomplished in that situation. So what I've learned in my research and studying of this situation is that some doctors love it and some doctors hate it. And you know what? The patients reflect that, meaning my patients have always said, I like the telemedicine visits. They're actually pretty good. You know, they save me time and money, and I feel we get a lot accomplished. I really like it. And that's because I like it and I'm promoting it and I'm telling them the value of it. And I set expectations on what the visit's going to be like. And I set rules for how I'm going to see you. Other doctors who hate it and complain about it, their patients worry. I don't want to do that thing that my doctor doesn't like to do. And why should I? It's inferior care. And the research shows it's not inferior care. The research shows that it can be just as good. So what I like to do is encourage patients to do telemedicine visits with their doctor if the doctor offers it. And right now, only about 20 to 30% of rheumatologists are offering telemedicine visits. They're very familiar. They like to do what they've always done. And telemedicine is a new thing that we had to do during COVID, but not enough stuck with it. But in the future, it is the future. We will have to do this because, as Dr. Trinita pointed out, there's manpower issues. And this is the most efficient use of the existing manpower to deliver services to people with musculoskeletal problems. So I would recommend that if your doctor offers it, grab it. Then you need to know, well, how is this going to work? What kind of exam will you do? How can you assess me? How often can I see you by laptop and computer versus see you in the office? And my rule was, in general, every other visit is going to be face-to-face and our next one would be a telemedicine, unless you lived, you know, more than 5 hours away. And then if I can, I'll do every third visit. But you still are going to have to come in, and you have to have rules for how that happens, that you do need to make the effort to travel so far to be seen face-to-face. And the rules generally are, if you have a sudden, new, severe problem, it may not be the wisest thing to do it over the phone or over the internet, that you may need to be seen. And that's kind of hard to swallow, because when you're really bad, you're not really able to travel. So it makes it difficult for you, the patient. The second thing is, what kind of visits, and basically status checks, medicine checks, safety checks, laboratory checks, medicine refills. We can do a lot of that via telemedicine and do it in a very efficient fashion. So again, having rules for this kind of engagement and knowing how often you're going to have to make the bigger effort for the bigger visit. I found that when I was doing telemedicine, that if I had two visits in a row with a patient, they wanted to make the third and the fourth visit telemedicine because it was so good, so convenient, seemed to work just as well as when I went there. And it's my job to, again, set the expectation that we can't only do this. You know, I have great communication skills. I have enough knowledge to manage your problem. I have great observational skills, and I can do a lot by looking and, you know, going through a joint exam just with a camera. I can examine your hands and your neck and your shoulders and your knees and your feet just as well. But that's not quite as good as putting my hands on your knee or my being able to move your shoulder through a range of motion. There are things that can be discerned only by an actual physical examination where I get to touch and move your joints or examine your skin or look at your scalp very, very carefully for what's going on under there. So again, I'm a big proponent, but I do think that it has its limitations.
That's very true. I actually tell patients the same way. There are certain things that can be done through telemedicine, but there are also situations when it's best for them to come to be evaluated in the office. The convenience of seeing patients through telemedicine is something that patients love. And the fact that they don't have to take time from work, you know, arrange to for someone to stay with the kids, the fact that they don't have to travel, wait in a waiting room with other people, get sick there, that's the part that they enjoy the most. The other thing is that the access, you know, if you are remote and you don't have access in your area to a rheumatologist, you can access another rheumatologist that is farther away from you. But like you said, there are certain things that could be done and certain things that could not be done. I was like you, I was following you for a long time, and I want to congratulate you because you were the first and I think the only rheumatologist that I've seen that you came out online. You did a movie that was on YouTube to teach other rheumatologists how to assess a patient through telemedicine. I kind of learned through a trial and error, and then I was bringing patients in the office. But the way that you were teaching other rheumatologists, I really enjoy that because, like you said, you have the eye, you have the communication skills, you have the expertise, but not all of us, we have it. So that video, I do encourage other younger rheumatologists to watch it because it's very well done and very comprehensive.
Yeah. And I like what you mentioned earlier about being remote and coming in at times and maybe having a local doctor. You know, I have a lot of patients from out of state, and either because the state and the place that they live in doesn't have any rheumatologist, so they come all the way to Dallas, or because they have a very rare disease of which I'm an expert in. And they'll travel all the way from California or Maine or St. Louis or wherever to see me. And in many of these situations, I co-manage the patient with another doctor. It can be a local doctor. It can be another rheumatologist. And I find that that has always worked out very well. You know, what I worry about is if you're far, far away and I'm your rheumatologist, you do need to have a primary care doctor where you live because they're going to be available to you on a Thursday night when things go wrong. You know, trying to get in touch with me on a Thursday night when I'm three states away is not going to be very useful to you and could be a serious problem. So having someone that you can rely on locally, but maybe a specialist that you see via distance is a really good option for people who don't live in the big cities or close to, you know, many rheumatology options.
That's true. Now, I'm going to ask you also about traveling. You know, a lot of our patients with rheumatoid arthritis, they use medication. Some of the medications, they need to keep them in certain conditions. Do you have any tips for these people that need to travel and they do have to carry the medication with them?
I hate to plug, but I have this really spelled out well on my website, roomnow.com, roomnow.com. I have a blog I wrote called Tips for Arthritis Travelers, and it goes over many, many things that you probably never thought of. But a few of the big ones that I would recommend, the most common question we get is, can I take my medicine through TSA? And do I need to, if I have a biologic injectable medicine, do I need to wrap it in an ice pack or carry a cooler or something like that? Number one, you don't need to worry about TSA. I don't think they've ever stopped anyone regarding medicines. And if you look at their website, you can, as long as your medicine is, it should be in the original bottle with your name on it, as opposed to you sticking 12 medicines into, you know, a mayonnaise jar and saying, these are mine. That looks suspicious. But your medicines in your bottle with your name on it are just fine. If you have an injectable medicine that you normally keep in the refrigerator and you take out of the refrigerator, give to yourself as a injectable, the moment you take it out of the refrigerator, it's good for at least 30 days and probably 6 weeks at room temperature. So I just tell patients, just wrap it up in something to keep it cool and out of sunlight. I'll keep it away from the heat. And you're good to travel with that on the longest of vacations. And you don't need to know about that. I think common sense goes a long way in traveling. Like, it's not wise to travel when you're a mess, when you're swollen up and hurting and flaring. And boy, that's, you're just asking for trouble. You always travel when you're in your best condition or when you're well controlled. You travel with your medicines. You travel with your medicine list. You have a plan for what's going to happen when things go wrong. Like, is there a hospital there? You know, if you've been recently sick, you want to know what you can do. I like to tell patients, go over with them specific medicines, because traveling can be stressful and painful, meaning you may walk a lot at your job and around your city and running errands, but walking through airports and traveling a few thousand miles at 30,000 feet is very, very physically and immunologically hard. So I like to tell my patients on the day that they're traveling, the day after they travel, that they should increase their medicines. So if you're taking acetaminophen or Tylenol, you take two a day, take four a day. If you're taking a few Advil a day, then maybe I would make it more. But you have to go over this with your doctor. Quite commonly, I'll take people who are on prednisone and say, double your prednisone the day you travel and the day after you travel. And the days that you're skiing and the days that you're walking through Berlin and wherever it is you're going. Because they want to travel and enjoy themselves just like the rest of us. And if you can help them by just giving them a little extra to help with the extra pain that they'll ensue, that they'll get. You know, when the first time I think I went to London, I walked all day and I went back to my hotel room and I sat in the bathtub for about 14 hours because it was just, I wasn't used to walking. Like, I must have walked, I think, 12 miles and I wasn't used to it. And imagine if you had arthritis and you were doing all that. It's not uncommon to prepare yourself. So a lot of all rheumatologists will know the scenario well. A patient comes in and says, I need an injection because I'm going on a long trip. I need an injection because I want to be able to dance at my daughter's wedding. You know, we're talking about maybe a steroid injection in a joint or a steroid injection that works systemically, or we're talking about other sort of pain approaches. Discussing this with your doctor prior to go, it can really improve the quality of your trip and vacation. And that's really, we're just as invested in that as you are. So be sure to put that on your list of questions when you go in to see your doctor, when you are going to travel.
That's absolutely great. The last question, I know that we should be very respectful to your time. You know that many patients with rheumatoid arthritis, they're very interested to find out about natural ways, natural remedies to treat inflammation and rheumatoid arthritis. What can you advise them regarding this natural approach?
I'm very open to natural approaches, but my job is to make sure that you don't hurt yourself by the choices you make. And often you, the patient, will do your own research and find out a lot of things. And you'll take the advice of your neighbor and your clergyman and the people at church or the woman that you work next to, you know, and you'll try those things that they recommend. And most of those are foolish, outright foolish. You need to ask an expert. And I can say foolish with great assurance. And I can tell you 10 things that I would strongly recommend. I can tell you 20 things that I would, you know, I have a rule that a lot of vitamins and fad diets, I call it like Kush rule number 7, that the more it costs, the less it works. When someone, a neighbor, is telling you, oh, this, you know, this QAnol from this special corporation that my cousin works for, you know, is selling this thing and the bottle is $60. Well, that's going to be a total waste of money. I guarantee you. Okay. It's natural. It's over the counter. It's made by some guy named Paco. You know, it's not like there's any science here. So I think a good diet, I like to recommend probiotics. I think a good antioxidant and a multivitamin works very well. I think for certain disorders, I like an anti-inflammatory diet and a low gluten or no gluten diet. And that's psoriasis, psoriatic arthritis, spondyloarthritis, above all. Not so much in rheumatoid, definitely not in fibromyalgia. Weight loss works really well. Bed rest. If you're really bad, the best pill you can give yourself is get in bed and don't move for 3 days. I really mean bed rest. There's research showing that bed rest is more powerful than medicine if you really stay in bed, putting everything to rest. The stretching certainly works. I'm a big believer in vitamin D. I'm not a big believer in B6 or vitamin C or E for that matter. Again, a good multivitamin and a healthy diet is probably all one really needs. There are certain things that have been always advocated for arthritis, and there's some merit to pills that are made of berries, cherry extract, blueberry extract. Berry extracts are kind of anti-inflammatory, and there's good research to support that. But if you put that against medicines that I'm going to prescribe, they're poor. You know, they're weak anti-inflammatories. They may be natural, but that doesn't mean that they're totally safe because you're putting it in your body and how's your body going to react? Just because it sounds like it's natural doesn't mean that it's always safer. So the safest drug, the safest intervention is the one that works. A good example is glucosamine and cannabis. I know why I'm going to talk about this, but glucosamine, everybody wants to take because it sounds like it's something you're supposed to do. I did the world's largest study on glucosamines, published in New England Journal, and showed that placebo was better. Okay. Of my last 10 patients who took glucosamine with or without chondroitin sulfate, one said it worked great. Two said, maybe. But seven said, I don't know. But yet people are spending $50 a month on this and it's not really doing them any good. By contrast, and there's a lot of research on glucosamine also showing it doesn't really work all that well. The contrast, you know, this new move with the legalization of marijuana and cannabis products. Before that, CBD oil was available. And I got to tell you, if I asked the last 10 patients of mine who use CBD oil, it's like 7 or 8 out of 10 said it really helped them. And I don't know what to do with that because there's no great research on CBD oil. And there is some side effects. And it is unfortunately too expensive. You know, a little tiny bottle could be $60 or $90. And even worse, your best advice comes from some guy behind the counter named Paco, who doesn't have an advanced degree in anything other than selling the cannabis product. Now, is cannabis itself, gummies and things like that, any better? They're definitely not anti-inflammatory. They may be helpful in pain. They may be helpful in sleep. And sleep is a great way to improve pain. But I think that you really have to have a very detailed discussion with your patients. More than 50% of patients are taking natural over-the-counter products without their doctor's knowledge or consent. And the majority of that should not happen. Now, a lot of patients will not ask their doctor because they don't want to be ridiculed. They don't want to be told, oh, that's stupid. That's silly. I don't know why you would do that. You know, and honestly, a doctor that would say what your choice was stupid or silly is your invitation to find a new doctor. Your other invitation to find a new doctor is when they say, there's nothing I can do for you. Ooh, thank you. Thank you. This will be our last visit.
I love the fact that you brought into the discussion the industry of supplements and also the industry of CBD or cannabis. I recently put a couple of videos on my YouTube channel exactly about that. What is the research and what are the facts, not the myths of certain products helping patients. I am like you. I will always like to know what patients are taking because I am in that. I do agree with bridging of natural options that are proven to be safe, first to be safe. And then, you know, if they are safe and if they believe that it's helpful for them, then it's okay to bridge them with the medication for rheumatoid arthritis. But I always tell patients, don't ever believe that that's going to replace everything. Maybe you will be able to decrease the dose, but you should always think about adding natural options to bridge to your therapy, to your rheumatoid arthritis therapy. And when you are open like that, like you said, patients do appreciate it. Patients do not appreciate. Patients, like you said, they will not tell us that they are using certain supplements unless you specifically ask. And even when you ask, like you said, they don't want to be ridiculed. I appreciate that kind of discussion, and I would really enjoy our next discussion about cannabis. I did my own research, like you said. You know, patients will come to me and will say, this is so helpful. And I did find some research published by Dr. McDouglas in Canada. They are more open than us to use cannabis and cannabis products for managing chronic pain. The research, although is in animal studies, it seems to be promising, but still, we don't have enough research to say that this is translated in humans. So I would love to have that discussion with you to share what we know.
The discussion we have to have with our patients is really got to be guided by, it's our job to let the patient know that they're not hurting themselves and that they're not wasting their money.
Correct.
Because both of those things can happen with any intervention, whether it's the one that I prescribe or the one that you found out, you know, in the Penny Saver news or a conversation.
And from you, thank you so much for sharing so many tips for patients and also for doctors that are practicing rheumatology. I appreciate the time that you spend with us and your valuable input. And I hope that I will have you as a guest in a future podcast. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Diana. All the best.
To you as well. Thank you for joining Thriving with Arthritis podcast. If you find today's episode valuable, please subscribe. Consider to leave us a review, as your feedback helps us improve and reach out to more people like you. Remember, you are not alone in your journey with arthritis and autoimmune diseases. Together, we can learn, grow, thrive, and not just survive. Stay tuned for our next episode, where we will dive deeper into more topics that will matter to you. Until then, keep thriving.